surely.
It's funny how little things can mark a day in your mind. That Friday in 1988 was probably the most horrible one in my life. I didn't sleep well for 6 months after, and I lost 25 pounds because for a while I couldn't eat. But the way I mark it in time is by something nice. That was the day Herb Avery and Justin Islington brought me the bouquet of field flowers. Just before everything went crazy, that was. They were in my bad books, those two. They'd ruined a brand new linen skirt horsing around in the kitchen. I was no part of it, just a gal minding her own business, getting a cup of coffee, not paying attention. And isn't that mostly when they get you? Men, I mean. They'll be all right for a while. So you relax, even get lulled into thinking they might be basically sane after all, and then they just break out. Herb and that Islington came galloping into the kitchen like a couple of horses, yelling about some bet. Justin is thumping Herb all around the head and shoulders and hollering, "Pay up, you son of a buck, pay up!" And Herb is like, "We were just kidding around. You know I don't bet when I play cards. Let loose of me." But laughing, both of them, like loons. Justin was half up on Herb's back, hands around his neck, pretending to choke him. Herb was trying to shake him off, neither of them looking at me or even knowing I was there, standing by the Mr. Coffee in my brand new skirt. Just P.C.O. Pasternak, you know, part of the furniture. "Look out, you two galoots," I yelled, but it was too late. They ran smack into me before I could put my cup down, and there went the coffee, all down my front. Getting it on the blouse didn't bother me. It was just an old thing, but the skirt was brand new and nice. I'd spent half an hour the night before fixing the hem. I gave a yell, and they finally stopped pushing and thumping. Justin still had one leg around Herb's hip and his hands around his neck. Herb was looking at me with his mouth hung wide open. He was a nice enough fellow. About Islington, I couldn't say one way or the other. He was transferred over to Troop K and media before I really got to know him. But with his mouth hung open that way, Herb Avery looked as dumb as a bag of hammers. "Surely, oh, geez," he said. You know, he sounded like Archie, now that I think back. Same accent, just not quite as thick. "I never saw you there." "Well, I'm not surprised," I said, "with that other one trying to ride you like you were a horse in the goddamn Kentucky Derby." "Are you burned?" Justin asked. "You bet I'm burned," I said. "The skirt was $35 at JCPenney, and it's the first time I wore it to work, and it's ruined. You want to believe I'm burned?" "Well, jeepers, calm down, we're sorry," Justin said. He even had the gall to sound offended. And that's also men, as I've come to know them, pardon the philosophy. If they say they're sorry, you're supposed to go all mellow because that takes care of everything. Doesn't matter if they broke a window, blew up the powerboat, or lost the kids' college fund playing blackjack in Atlantic City. It's like, "Hey, I said I was sorry. Do you have to make a federal case of it?" "Surely," Herb started. "Not now, honey child, not now," I said. "Just get out of here, right out of my sight." Trooper Islington, meanwhile, had grabbed a handful of napkins off the counter and started mopping the front of my skirt. "Stop that," I said, grabbing his wrist. "What do you think this is, Free Feel Friday?" "I just thought, if it hasn't set in yet..." I asked him if his mother had any kids that lived, and he started in with, "Well, Jesus, if that's the way you feel," all huffy and offended. "Do yourself a favor," I said, "and go right now, before you end up wearing this goddamn coffee pot for a necklace." Out they went, more slinking than walking, and for quite a while afterward they steered wide around me, Herb shamefaced, and Justin Islington still wearing that puzzled, offended look. "I said I was sorry. What do you want, egg in your beer?" Then, a week later, on the day the shit hit the fan, in other words, they showed up in dispatch at 2 in the afternoon, Justin first, with the bouquet, and Herb behind him. Almost hiding behind him, it looked like, in case I should decide to start hucking paperweights at them. Thing is, I'm not much good at holding a grudge. Anyone who knows me will tell you that. I do all right with them for a day or two, and then they just kind of melt through my fingers. And the pair of them look cute, like little boys who want to apologize to teacher for cutting up Dickens in the back of the room during social studies. That's another thing about men that gets you, how in almost the blink of a damned eye they can go from being loudmouth galoots who cut each other in the bars over the least little thing. Baseball scores, for the love of God. To sweeties, right out of a Norman Rockwell picture. And the next thing you know, they're in your pants or trying to get there. Justin held out the bouquet. It was just stuff they'd picked in the field behind the barracks. Daisies, black-eyed Susans, things of that nature. Even a few dandelions, as I recall. But that was part of what made it so cute and disarming. If it had been hothouse roses they'd bought downtown instead of that kid's bouquet, I might have been able to stay mad a little longer. That was a good skirt, and I hate hemming the damn things anyway. Justin Islington out in front, because he had those blue-eyed football player good looks, complete with the one curl of dark hair tumbled over his forehead, supposed to make me melt, and sort of did. Holding the flowers out, shucks, oh gosh, teacher. There was even a little white envelope stuck in with the flowers. Surely, Justin said, solemn enough, but with that cute little twinkle in his eyes. We want to make up with you. That's right, Herb said. I hate having you mad at us. I do too, Justin said. I wasn't so sure that one meant it, but I thought Herb really did, and that was good enough for me. Okay, I said, and took the flowers. But if you do it again... We won't, Herb said. No way. Never. Which is what they all say, of course, and don't accuse me of being a hard ass either. I'm just being realistic. If you do, I'll thump you cross-eyed. I cocked an eyebrow at Islington. Here's something your mother probably never told you, you being a pointer instead of a setter. Sorry won't take a coffee stain out of a linen skirt. Be sure to look in the envelope, Justin said, still trying to slay me with those bright blue eyes of his. I put the vase down on my desk and plucked the envelope out of the daisies. This isn't going to puff sneezing powder in my face or anything like that, is it? I asked Herb. I was joking, but he shook his head earnestly. Looking at him that way, you had to wonder how he could ever stop anyone and give them a ticket for speeding or reckless driving without getting a ration of grief. But troopers are different on the highway, of course. They have to be. I opened the envelope, expecting a little Hallmark card with another version of I'm Sorry on it, this one written in flowery rhymes, but instead there was a folded piece of paper. I took it out, unfolded it, and saw it was a JCPenney gift certificate made out to me in the amount of $50. Hey, no, I said. All at once I felt like crying. And while I'm at it, that's the other thing about men. Just when you're at your most disgusted with them, they can lay you out with some gratuitous act of generosity, and all at once, stupid but true, instead of being mad, you feel ashamed of yourself for ever having had a mean and cynical thought about them. Fellas, you didn't need to. We did need to, Justin said. That was double dumb, horsing around in the kitchen like that. Triple dumb, Herb said. He was bobbing his head up and down, never taking his eyes off me. But this is too much, Islington said. Not according to our calculations. We had to figure in the annoyance factor, you see, as well as the pain and suffering. I didn't get burned. That coffee was only Luke. You're taking it, Shirley, Herb said very firmly. He hadn't gotten all the way back to being Mr. State Cop Marlboro Man, but he was well on his way. It's a done deal. I'm really glad they did that, and I'll never forget it. What happened later was so horrible, you see. It's nice to have something that can balance out a little bit of that horror. Some act of ordinary kindness, like two goofs paying not just for the skirt they spoiled, but for the inconvenience and exasperation, and giving me flowers on top of that. When I remember the other part, I try to remember those guys, too, especially the flowers they picked out back. I thanked them, and they headed upstairs, probably to play chess. There used to be a tournament here toward the end of every summer, with the winner getting this little bronze toilet seat called the Scranton Cup. All that kind of got left behind when Lieutenant Shane Dinks retired. The two of them left me with the look of men who've done their duty. I suppose that in a way they had. I felt that they had, anyway. And I could do my part by getting them a big box of chocolates or some winter hand warmers with what was left over from the gift certificate after I'd bought a new skirt. Hand warmers would be more practical, but maybe a little too domestic. I was their dispatcher, not their den mother, after all. They had wives to buy them hand warmers. Their silly little peace bouquet had been nicely arranged. There were even a few sprigs of green to give it that all-important town florist's feel, but they hadn't thought to add water. Arrange the flowers, then forget the water. It's a guy thing. I picked up the vase and started toward the kitchen, and that was when George Stankowski came on the radio, coughing and sounding scared to death. Let me tell you something you can file away with whatever else you consider to be the great truths of life. Only one thing scares a police communications officer more than hearing a trooper in the field actually sounding scared on the radio, and that's one calling in a 2999. Code 99 is general response required. Code 29, you look in the book and you see only one word under 29. The word is catastrophe. Base, this is 14. Code 2999, do you copy? 2-9-er, 9-er, 9-er. I put the vase with the wildflowers in it back down on my desk, very carefully. As I did, I had a very vivid memory, hearing on the radio that John Lennon had died. I was making breakfast for my dad that day. I was going to serve him and then just dash because I was late for school. I had a glass bowl with eggs in it curled against my stomach. I was beating them with a whisk when the man on the radio said that Lennon had been shot in New York City. I set the glass bowl down in the same careful way I now set down the vase. Tony, I called across the barracks, and at the sound of my voice, or the sound of what was in my voice, everyone stopped what they were doing. The talk stopped upstairs as well. Tony, George Stankowski is 2999. And without waiting, I scooped up the microphone and told George that I copied, 5-by, and come on back. My 20 is Country Road 46, Poteenville, he said. I could hear an uneven crackling sound behind his transmission. It sounded like fire. Tony was standing in my doorway by then, and Sandy Dearborn in his civvies, with his cop shoes hung from the fingers of one hand. A tanker truck has collided with a school bus and is on fire. That's the tanker that's on fire, but the front half of the school bus is involved. Copy that? Copy, I said. I sounded okay, but my lips had gone numb. This is a chemical tanker, Norco West. Copy? I copy Norco West, 14, writing it on the pad beside the red telephone in large capital letters. Plaques? Short for placards. The little diamonds with icons for fire, gas, radiation, and a few other fun things. Can't make out the plaques, too much smoke, but there's white stuff coming out and it's catching fire as it runs down the ditch and across the highway. Copy that? George had started coughing into his mic again. Copy, I said. Are you breathing fumes, 14? You don't sound so good. Over. Roger that. Roger fumes, but I'm okay. The problem... But before he could finish, he started coughing again. Tony took the mic from me. He patted my shoulder to say I'd been doing all right. He just couldn't bear to stand there listening anymore. Sandy was putting on his shoes. Everyone else was drifting toward dispatch. There were quite a few guys there with the shift change coming up. Even Mr. Dillon had come out of the kitchen to see what all the excitement was about. "The problem's the school," George went on when he could. "Poteenville Grammar is only 200 yards away. School's not in for almost another month, 14. You... Break. Maybe not, but I see kids." Behind me, someone murmured, "August is crafts month out there. My sister's teaching pottery to 9- and 10-year-olds. I remember the terrible sinking feeling I got in my chest when I heard that. "Whatever the spill is, I'm upwind of it," George went on when he could. "The school isn't. I repeat, the school is not. Copy." "Copy, 14, Tony said. "Do you have FD support?" "Negative, but I hear sirens." More coughing. "I was practically on top of this when it happened, close enough to hear the crash, so I got here first. Grass is on fire. Fire's headed toward the school. I see kids on the playground standing around and watching. I can hear the alarm inside, so I have to guess they've been evac'd. Can't tell if the fumes have gotten that far, but if they haven't, they will. Send the works, boss. Send the farm. This is a legitimate 29. Tony. "Are there casualties on the bus, 14? Do you see casualties? Over." I looked at the clock. It was 2:15. If we were lucky, the bus would have been coming, not going, arriving to take the kids home from making their pots and jars. "Bus appears empty except for the driver. I can see him, or maybe it's her, slumped over the wheel. That's the half in the fire, and I'd have to say the driver is DRT. Copy?" DRT is a slang abbreviation the PSP picked up in the ERs back in the 70s. It stands for dead right there. "Copy, 14, Tony said. "Can you get to where the kids are?" Cough, cough, cough. He sounded bad. "Roger, base. There's an access road runs alongside the soccer field, goes right to the building. Over." "Then get in gear," Tony said. He was the best I ever saw him that day, as decisive as a general on the field of battle. The fumes turned out not to be all that toxic after all, and most of the burning was leaking gasoline, but of course none of us knew that then. For all George Stankowski knew, Tony had just signed his death warrant, and sometimes that's the job, yes. "Roger, base. Rolling. If they're getting gassed, stuff them in your cruiser. Sit them on the hood and the trunk. Put them on the roof hanging onto the light bars. Get as many as you can. Copy that?" "Copy, base. 14 out." Click. That last click seemed very loud. Tony looked around. 2999, you all heard it. Assigned units all rolling. Those of you waiting for switchover rides at 3, get Kojak lights out of the supply room and run your personals. Shirley, bend every duty officer you can raise. Yes, sir. Should I start calling ODs? Not yet. Huddy Royer, where are you? Here, Sarge. You're anchoring. There were no movie show protests about this from Huddy. Nothing about how he wanted to be out there with the rest of the crew, fighting fire and poison gas, rescuing children. He just said, "Yes, sir." Check Pogus County FD, find out what they're rolling, find out what Lassberg and Statler's rolling, call Pittsburgh OER, anyone else you can think of. How about Norco West? Tony didn't quite slap his forehead, but almost. Oh, you bet. Then he headed for the door. Kurt beside him, the others right behind them, Mr. Dillon bringing up the rear. Huddy grabbed his collar. "Not today, boy. You're here with me and Shirley." Mr. D sat down at once. He was well-trained. He watched the departing men with longing eyes, just the same. All at once, the place seemed very empty, with just the two of us there. The three of us, if you counted D. Not that we had time to dwell on it. There was plenty to do. I might have noticed Mr. Dillon getting up and going to the back door, sniffing at the screen and whining way back low in his throat. I think I did, actually, but maybe that's only hindsight at work. If I did notice, I probably put it down to disappointment at being left behind. What I think now is that he sensed something starting to happen out in Shed B. I think he might have even been trying to let us know. I had no time to mess with the dog, though. Not even time enough to get up and shut him in the kitchen, where he might have had a drink from his water bowl and then settled down. I wish I'd made time. Poor old Mr. D might have lived another few years. But of course I didn't know. All I knew right then was that I had to find out who was on the road and where. I had to bend them west if I could and if they could. And while I worked on that, Huddy was in the SC's office, hunched over the desk and talking into the phone with the intensity of a man who's making the biggest deal of his life. I got all my active officers except for Unit 6, which was almost here. 20 base and a tick had been my last word from them. George Morgan and Eddie Jackaboy had a delivery to make before heading over to Poteenville. Except, of course, 6 never did get to Poteenville that day. No, Eddie and George never got to Poteenville at all.